From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama is off to Alaska today for a three-day trip that will focus almost entirely on climate change.
Mr. Obama's visit is going to highlight the visible effects of climate change in Alaska, the rising sea levels, the melting glaciers and permafrost. It'll be the first time a sitting president visits the Alaskan Arctic. Before the president kicked off this trip, he announced that the highest peak in North America, Mount McKinley, will be renamed Denali. That is the traditional Native Alaskan name. It means the tall one. Zachariah Hughes is a reporter with Alaska Public Media. He is with us now in Anchorage. Hi, Zachariah.
Hello. How are you?
Good. How are Alaskans reacting to the president's visit and this particular focus on climate change?
Well, like everything in Alaska, it's a little bit of a mix. There's definitely a lot of excitement that the president's coming. It's his first trip independent of a refueling stop a few years ago. But, you know, it's a mix. The congressional delegation has made remarks about some of the climate change and energy policy implications that the president's likely to speak on. There's just a good deal of activity. I will say the renaming of Mount McKinley to Denali, which it you know, everyone in Alaska sort of already calls it. That has been greeted, I would say, with uniform praise and acceptance and excitement. When that news broke yesterday, there was a lot of activity around the state and people just generally expressing a kind of woof, finally.
Why is that
reaction?
Yeah, why is the reaction sort of finally? And you know, we've been doing it all along.
There's a long tradition in Alaska of places being named for people that have never been here or after events or just naming things after stuff that's not from here, that's not local. So, you know, President McKinley never visited Alaska. So while it may seem kind of small and insignificant, this is the highest point in all of North America. And for it to not take its Koyukon Athabaskan name for so long and for such kind of middling, arbitrary historical reasons was somewhere between a slap in the face and, you know, one more instance of kind of sustained vexed relations with the lower 48.
Yes, although we could say that the Ohio delegation, President McKinley from Ohio, would not say it's sort of insignificant and middling. But so this is part of the backdrop that Obama is coming into now. And Alaska, of course, is a largely conservative state, heavily dependent on oil revenues, which have been falling significantly. It's a state, though, that is central for environmentalists as well, who are extremely unhappy about something that the president has done just very recently, and that is to allow expanded drilling in the Arctic. This is a tough line he's walking there. Tell us what environmentalists are saying.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very mixed, and it's a very complicated issue for Alaska. I mean, 90% of our state revenues for the operating budget come from oil, and the politics of which is good oil and which is bad oil is a little bit complicated and tricky. So you'll hear the pipeline used as a stand-in for kind of all that's right with energy futures. And our governor and a lot of our state legislators will talk about filling the pipeline and not limiting access to the oil patch up north on the North Slope. You know, at the same time, Arctic offshore has had a lot of increased attention in recent years. I mean, you know, even ahead of Shell's 2012 exploratory season and that resumption this summer. There are environmental groups, I should say, staging protests today to kind of confront the president with the irony of making, you know, pronouncements on climate change and conservation while at the same time his administration permitted some offshore development just very recently. Those last permits were kind of signed off on. So it's mixed. And in Alaska, I would say the people that are the closest to the issue itself have some of the most developed and complicated opinions about it, whether that's some of the mayors and administrators in the far northern communities, particularly the North Slope, which has benefited economically tremendously from the oil boom in the last three or four decades, and now the Northwest Arctic Borough kind of taking a tentatively approving step towards the exploratory season. I mean, it's really complicated. There's direct economic consequences on a day-to-day level from some of these groups being allowed to be here, while at the same time, widespread and very candid recognition that the sea ice is retreating, which really is throwing a kink in the way people have lived for centuries. Permafrost levels are dropping. These are real things that are happening on the ground in Alaska, and year to year, there's just really dramatic effects that are being seen. So, you know, it's not that Alaskans don't realize that climate change is here, that it's tied to energy extraction, but, you know, these are global problems. There's oil coming out of the earth all over the world. And
let me just interrupt there, yeah. Zachariah. What do Alaskans want to come out of this trip?
I think Alaskans are excited for the attention and want more than anything else for climate and energy futures to be handled on their terms instead of the lower 48s or the very far away federal governments. I think Alaskans want more of an Alaskan take on what's going on and more of a say-so in how that happens.
Okay. Thank you. Speaking to us from Anchorage, Alaska, Zachariah Hughes with Alaska Public Media. Nice to speak with you.
Thank you. Nice to speak with you as well.
Well, the man who police say shot and killed a Houston area sheriff's deputy on Friday night is being held without bail after his first court appearance this morning. The accused, Shannon Miles, is black. The deputy, Darren Goforth, what a name, was white. Police say they didn't know each other but allege that Miles targeted Goforth, shooting him in the back 15 times. Now his death is being tied to the rhetoric of protests that's taken shape after cases of officers killing unarmed black men. Sheriff Ron Hickman said this at a news conference over the weekend.
Any point when the rhetoric ramps up to the point where calculated, cold-blooded assassination of police officers happened, this rhetoric has gotten out of control. We've heard Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter. Well, cops' lives matter, too.
Supporters of that sentiment point to the Black Lives Matter marchers who used anti-police chants at the Minnesota State Fair just hours after Deputy Goforth was killed.
Pigs in a blanket, fry like bacon! Pigs in a blanket, fry like bacon!
The chant referring to police. Black Lives Matter's leaders have also spoken out. We'll get to that. But first, Craig Cohen is host of Houston Matters on Here and Now contributing station KUHF. Craig, how is all this reverberating where you are?
Well, it's, of course, leading to shock and frustration. Shock about the violence, frustration that no apparent motive has really come to light, some anger about it becoming politically charged so quickly. But frankly, what else is new in 2015 America?
That something becomes politically charged. But what more do we know about the suspect?
The suspect is Shannon Miles. He's 30 years old. He's from Cypress. That's the same neighborhood that Deputy Darren Goforth is from. The Houston Chronicle studied some court records and found he has a long rap sheet. He's been arrested 7 times between 2005 and 2009 for everything from criminal mischief to discharging or displaying a firearm, evading arrest, criminal trespass. But again, there's no indication of a motive, no indication that he even knew the deputy.
Well, and there's security video also that shows a man who looks like Shannon Miles approaching the deputy whose back is turned to him and shooting him. Well, back to the theory that rhetoric from the Black Lives Matter movement might have prompted this shooting. On CNN this morning, DeRay McKesson, who's a leader in the Black Lives Matter movement, which started a year ago after Michael Brown was shot and killed by an officer in Ferguson, he said he thought it was unfortunate that Sheriff Hickman blamed the movement for what's a charged climate.
This is only charged in the context of a profession that refuses any accountability. It's interesting, again, that when we think about policing, I would hope that police officers conduct investigations before they make accusatory statements.
What's the feeling there in Houston, Craig, about this, you know, bringing the Black Lives Matter movement into this shooting?
Well, there's a little bit of a split there, as you might imagine. There are those whose sentiments are very much with law enforcement, but we've also heard responses, just like you mentioned, we heard DeRay McKesson there. He had another statement, which he put out on Twitter, where he says, "I grieve for the victims of violence. It's sad that some have chosen to politicize this tragedy." And I suspect that there are those who feel, yes, that's exactly what they're doing. The question really comes down to if law enforcement start by using such charged language, can it lead then to mistrust that they will handle the investigation like any other homicide? Mm-hmm. It sort of reinforces this growing sense of disconnect and mistrust between law enforcement and communities nationwide.
That they've already come to a conclusion about something they haven't investigated yet. But is there a sense that it's open season on police officers? Last week, we saw an officer, a state trooper, who approached a man in Louisiana to help him, and he was shot and killed, but the person who shot him was white. What is the sense that officer killings are on the rise?
I don't know if it's necessarily that officer killings are on the rise, though there is an interesting stat. According to the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund, there have been 10 officers who have died in Texas this year. That's 10 out of 80 nationwide. That 80 total represents a 10% increase in deaths so far this year. But the language that we're hearing in large part is coming from law enforcement saying that they are getting pushback in general from the community. And then, of course, we've all been witness to the community at large in many cases saying we don't trust law enforcement. So that divide exists.
But interestingly, USA Today reports that according to the website Officer Down Memorial page, non-accidental shooting deaths of police officers have actually gone down. So the debate will continue. But Craig, it is obvious, though, that there's been an outpouring of grief and support for this officer and his family where you are.
Yes, 1,000 people showed up Sunday night for a march from a couple of area churches to the gas station where the shooting occurred. Without question, there is a great outpouring of support for the officer's family.
Craig Cohen, host of Houston Matters on Here Now, contributing station KUHF. Craig, thank you.
You're quite welcome.
It's Here and Now. This week, the movie A Walk in the Woods opens in theaters. It's based on the 1998 novel of the same name. It tells the real-life story of author Bill Bryson. He and his friend Stephen Katz attempted to hike all 2,189 miles of the Appalachian Trail. The two men were in their 40s at the time. They are completely out of shape, facing their lack of experience and learning a lot about nature and about themselves. Robert Redford and Nick Nolte play the pair in the movie. The actors are in their 70s now, also out of shape and facing old age. Here's a clip from the film. The two men are being confronted by younger hikers on the trail.
You guys doing all right?
Yeah, no, we're fine.
Because look, when we get over to the other side, we can just come back and grab your packs if you want. You know, it's easy for us.
Not a problem.
Happy to help.
We like hard. We don't like easy. But thanks a lot, you know.
All right, then.
So for 40-year-olds or 70-year-olds or 20-year-olds, how hard is it to hike the Appalachian Trail? Warren Doyle is director and instructor of the Appalachian Trail Institute. He has completed the trail 17 times and trains others to do so as well. For the price of a donation only, he leads them along the complicated terrain. And we caught up with him along the trail at the AMC Highland Center in Crawford Notch, New Hampshire, and asked him why he did the trail for the first time way back when and why he still hikes it today.
Well, I was 23 years old then, and, you know, basically I wanted to prove to myself who I was and how much I could give and how much I could take. I started to question being a product of our general society, so I read up about walkabouts and pilgrimages, you know, away from societal institutions, and I decided that I'd go on a 2,080-mile pilgrimage, and that's when I did it in record time, and I wanted to do it that way because I wanted to make it hard on myself. You know, the trail didn't give me any favors and treated me the same as anybody else would. So I learned a lot about myself and where I wanted to go in the future. And that led a couple years later to organizing the first group to do the Appalachian Trail, and that was in 1975, and there was 19 students, primarily from the University of Connecticut, where I was a grad student at the time, and we walked the whole trail. And the thing that really stood out is that all 19 people who started finished.
Which is very unusual, and you have a pretty good record at that, because you're still leading tours today. In fact, really today.
Yes, this is my ninth group. It's been, you know, 40 years, and it's something I just do on my own. It's grassroots. It's folk. You know, it's not institutionalized, and basically it's a labor of love, and the most productive way I could be spending my time as a social change educator.
I want to talk about the social change in a second, but when you first set out at 23 years old, you said you were tired of societal institutions. You wanted to break away. You wanted to be on your own. The Appalachian Trail has become something of an institution itself, and it's not always solitary up there. And you're going with 12 people, I think, on your most recent hike. What's the motivation now? Because you're not necessarily getting away from it all.
In a way, the expeditions, they really don't happen. There's no other groups doing the trail because it's non-commercial. No one is paid. There are no liability forms that we sign, and And so it's very old school. So it isn't institutionalized at all, and that's the beauty of it. And you mentioned in your first question about why am I still hiking it, because of the freedom and the simplicity. And it's still much different than real society.
Describe it for us. You say it's different from real society. What is it like?
Well, it's very simple. You either do it or you don't. You either get 15 miles closer to the mountain today or you don't do it. It takes hard effort. No one's walking the trail for you. You have to walk it on your own 2 feet. You know, we're made and we're built to walk. We're not made to, you know, win a gold medal in the balance beam or the rings in the Olympics, but we're made to walk. And just walking a long way is open to a lot of people. And I like that.
And as part of your kind of edict, you have issued 13 statements of wisdom. And one
yes.
of them is walking the, it's been an education to read these, actually, Warren. One of them is walking the entire Appalachian Trail is not recreation. This is an education and a job. And another says that the Appalachian Trail is not going on a hike. It's a challenging task, a journey with deeper ramifications. It's kind of zen what you're saying here. You're saying that the trail cannot be changed, the time, the distance, the terrain, the weather. You have to change. I really
That's
hate
correct.
That idea.
Well, the people that don't want to change don't finish it.
Yeah, or don't start it.
Right. But a lot of people start it because they feel that they're going to have control over it. And when they feel that they don't have control over it, they don't want to give up that control.
Give me an example. I mean, I think a lot of people who go with you on the expeditions have to probably learn that as they're in progress. How does that happen? What have you seen?
Yeah, actually, they learned that during the preparation period, the 20 days prior. And so it's sort of like, what would happen if people would learn how it really is to have children and raise children and the challenges of adolescents and teenagers and stuff like that before they actually had children or, even marriage. Like whenever you make a long-term commitment, if you decide that you want to walk from Georgia to Maine, that is a long-term commitment.
And how long?
Well, most people who backpack it, and you don't have to backpack the whole trail, but most people who backpack the trail do it between 5 and 6 months. And
so that's
a long time.
Yeah, that's a big commitment. And there is a lot of learning on the way. Can you give us an example of how you inculcate the people coming with you into learning to, go with the flow of the mountains?
Well, we start, we have practice hikes, and we're actually out there walking 20 miles a day, day hiking, so people can realize what does it feel to walk all day? What does it feel like to walk from sun up to sundown? Do you want to do something like that for, 140 days? It's hard. It's not fun. And the only way it becomes fun is if we accept that it's going to be difficult, then we could start having fun. Because walking the Appalachian Trail is counterculture, because our culture is based on comfort, and walking the trail is not comfortable.
Yeah, and what
our culture is based on convenience and saving time.
Right, taking shortcuts.
And this takes a long time. Somebody could ride a bicycle 20 miles in, 20 miles would take you all day to walk. So it's not fast.
So give me an example of something that maybe happened on this trip or the previous trip where the whole had to work on behalf of the individual.
Oh, yes. Expedition 2010, we had an individual in his 60s who had fallen and scraped himself in Pennsylvania on a rock. And from that point on, he became very frightened about rock ledges and rock outcroppings. And when we got up to the White Mountains here, he was just very fearful because it's very rugged here. And it became very apparent that we had to help him. And so for the last 20 days on the trail in Maine, everyone took a two-person shifts once every 6 days. And one person would be directly in front of him and one person would be directly in back of him to help him through all the steep rock ledges. And it was just a beautiful experience. And the last day we climbed Katahdin, it was the remnants of a tropical storm, and it rained 4 inches that day. And we climbed the mountain, and people were with him the whole way. both up Katahdin and down Katahdin. It was just a beautiful group experience.
You say that when the people you're with finish the trail, they sometimes let out shouts of joy. They sometimes cry. What do you do?
Oh, I cry profusely.
Still?
Oh, yes. Remember the end of Rudyard Kipling's Jungle Book, when Bagheera told Mowgli, "And now you must go back to man." And Mowgli cried and cried and cried. I love my real life. I've started a folk school in my retirement where I live down in northeast Tennessee, and I'm looking forward to going back and putting on contra dance weeks and weekends and running my Appalachian Trail Institute out of the folk school. I really love it there. So I'm leaving a place rather than, you know, cash, basically. So
yeah,
so,
but
yeah, I'm very excited about that.
Not yet, though, right? You still have a couple more treks ahead of you.
Yeah, I'll be organizing a 2017 expedition because, you know, I feel my clock is ticking. And then I may hike the trail one more time when I'm 70, if I'm able to, just so I could say that I've walked the trail once every decade for six decades, which shows a devotion. And commitment and devotion are very important to me.
That's Warren Doyle, who's the director and instructor of the Appalachian Trail Institute. We checked in with him earlier today, and he told us that he and his group of 12 are in Rangeley, Maine right now, so they still have a few more weeks to go. And by the way, Robin, the average age of the hikers who join him is 57. He himself is 65 years old, and as you heard, he wants to hike well into his 70s.
He also told us about how hard it is, the rock climb at the end. It's pretty tough, and there's a move to change the end of the trail, Lisa, because people are partying too much there. But anyway, as we said, Robert Redford plays Bill Bryson in the film Walk in the Woods. He's almost 80. He told us filming the hike was hard.
We didn't hike the whole Appalachian Trail, but we felt like we did because we would hike sections that were going uphill. You do one take, then you go back and do it again, then you do it again. After six, seven, eight takes, you're really pooped.
So tomorrow, Robert Redford on getting older and walking in the woods, here and now.
A familiar sound today as the U.S. Open got underway in Flushing Meadows, New York, and the most watched player is going to be taking the court tonight. Serena Williams is trying to become the first woman since 1988 to win all four major tennis championships in one calendar year, a Grand Slam. And the anticipation over whether she will do so is now hitting the ticket office. Joining us to explain is Jill Schlesinger of CBS News. Hi, Jill.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. If Serena Williams wins the U.S. Open, she's got a Grand Slam. The last time that happened was with Steffi Graf back in 1988. So how is that influencing ticket sales?
Women's finals sold out just before the men's, actually. It's amazing. It's the first time in history, and I think that has a lot to do with Serena. Who doesn't want to be at an event where history is made? You know, look, this is also going to be an event where we could see Serena tie Steffi Graf for the 22nd major title. And that puts her in striking distance of kind of getting to, I think, 34, which is the all-time high number of major titles.
And Williams has to make the final, of course. But the winner of the U.S. Open will take home more than $3 million. Not bad. Men and women get equal prize money in all the major tennis tournaments, although that hasn't always been the case. How does that compare with other sports?
Actually, it's pretty darn good. I mean, a lot of guys that I talk to, and you know what's so funny? My first boyfriend from high school was a tennis player. He was a professional tennis player. And he's like, well, why should you get paid as much? We pay five sets. You pay three sets. You know, so it was like really nutty. But honestly, since 2007, and Billie Jean King was really the trailblazer in trying to get equal pay for women. But, you know, it really is pretty amazing. I was looking this up, the PGA Tour, right, for golf. Total prize money for the PGA, $340 million, more than five times what the women get on the LPGA. And how about the WNBA? I was looking at this. The maximum salary in the WNBA, $109,000. Dare I say, the NBA salary, quite a bit more than that. It's $16 million.
Yeah, and dare I say, I'm glad you dropped that first boyfriend. When you look at the total annual earnings of Serena Williams, this includes endorsements. She is actually not the highest paid female tennis player, although she is ranked number one. Who's paid the most?
Maria Sharapova. And as a dark-haired woman, I'm going to say it's all about the blonde thing, I guess. I'm not sure. Listen, Serena earned about $25 million over the last calendar year through June 2015, okay? Sharapova, about $30 million. Sharapova is actually the world's highest paid female athlete for the last 11 years. And number three on the list is Caroline Wozniacki. She's get $14.5 million. But of course, like $14.5 million, $11 million in endorsements. So, you know, it definitely pays to be a hot Russian or Dutch woman because you get paid more.
Thank you. Jill Schlesinger of CBS News, thanks for speaking with us. Assume you're going to be watching tonight, Jill.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I'm a big Serena fan, so this is a great segment for me.
Excellent. This is Here and Now.
When Daniel James Brown's The Boys in the Boat was published in 2013, it was a huge success. Over 150 weeks on the bestseller lists, one of our personal favorites. It's the true story of the 8-oar rowing team at the University of Washington in the 1930s. The sons of loggers, farmers, shipyard workers, most of whom had never even been in a boat before they came to school. But they ended up beating teams from more elite schools and then took on the world at the Olympics in Berlin, winning the gold medal, inching out the Italian and German boats under the watchful eye of Hitler. You can hear our 2013 interview with Daniel James Brown at hereandnow.org. As he told us then, the boy's story inspired the country. But now the question is, will it inspire young readers today? Daniel James Brown has come up with a new young adult version of his book. It's called The Boys in the Boat, the true story of an American team's epic journey to win gold at the 1936 Olympics. It's in stores next week. And Daniel joins us from Seattle to talk about this new version. Daniel, welcome.
Hi.
And what timing? We're reading that young adult books are, you know, the market's exploding in part because of Common Core requirements that kids read more and be tested on critical thinking. There's a huge lift in nonfiction sales for young people. So were you thinking, I'll ride that wave? Did someone approach you? I mean, how did this happen?
No, it was more, at least from my vantage point, a matter of getting emails. I mean, I get emails every day about the book, of course, and certain things come up over and over. And one of the things that's been coming up a lot lately is parents and grandparents and teachers saying, boy, I wish there was an edition of this book that my kids or my students could read for themselves. And from the publisher's viewpoint, as you say, it is a trend. There's more and more interest in publishing books that bring history to life. Teachers are always looking for books that that enliven history. And I think books like this fit into that niche.
Books like Unbroken are hugely popular for young people. And you also are seeing young people at your readings.
Yeah. Initially, when the adult version came out, most of the people that came to my readings were older. But just particularly in the last year, I've had more and more young people who've either had the book read to them or who are far enough along to read the book for themselves come to the readings and come up afterwards and want their book signed. And I've been talking to them, you know, about why the story interested them. And there's a whole range of reasons, but it mostly has to do with they're really attracted by the idea of a story about young people who have set goals for themselves and have to overcome obstacles because it resonates in their own lives.
Well, when we talked and when we read the book, we said to you, did you make this up? You know, because it is, it's that perfect template of a story. It's the young, hardscrabble people who come into a competitive world that they know nothing about, and they Rocky-like rise to the top, and it's got all this history around it. Just remind people, at the center you have Joe Rance, the rower. His mother died when he was young. Stepmother didn't want him. He was kind of abandoned, told to live on his own when he was in high school. I mean, really a compelling story. Tell us more.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. He was literally left standing on the porch of a half-finished house out in Squim, Washington, and wound up having to forage in the woods for food and poach salmon from the river and make his own way in the world. And eventually he did, and he formed his own identity. And I think that's part of what appeals to young people is I think, you know, most young people today don't have that kind of experience. But I think it's pretty universal among young people as they enter adolescence that they feel detached from the adults in their world and feel a need to go out and create their own identity. So I think it resonates on that level.
You, by the way, met him before he died. His daughter Judy was your neighbor. He told you the story of the boat decades after it happened. What other lessons can young people take, did you think, from his story?
There are certain virtues or character traits that he developed that I think stand any young person in good stead. He learned perseverance. He learned how to trust people because after being abandoned by his parents, he didn't really trust anybody in the world. And he learned that he had to come to trust the other people on the crew if he was going to succeed at that.
Well, actually, that alone is a terrific story, how the members of the team had to pull together. Literally.
Yeah. Yeah, he had to learn to fit in with other people. And that's really the center of it, is that that's challenging for any young person, or at least often is challenging for young people. And he also learned the importance of being earnest about what he was doing. You know, he and all these guys in the boat, they took pride in what they were doing. And of course, they took pride when they were rowing in Germany, representing the United States in the Olympics. But it was much more than that. They took pride in their tasks. They took pride in their work as a crew every time they went out. And that was a lesson and a revelation, I think, not just for Joe, but for all of them.
What did you feel you had to leave out of the book because it's a young person's book? It's shorter. It's still a healthy read. So what did you feel you had to leave out?
Well, we left out some of the more esoteric discussions, for instance, of what was happening in Germany. In the adult version, there's quite a bit of talk about the exact nature of the propaganda machine that the Nazis put in place and how Leni Riefenstahl's film contributed to that and some of the economic background of what was happening in Germany. And much of that came out, but we wanted to leave enough in so that kids got a broad exposure to what was happening in Germany in those years leading up to the Olympics, and more importantly, how the Nazis used the Olympics as this propaganda device to deceive the rest of the world.
But you don't shy away from talking about the growing anti-Semitism.
No.
There's a little less we noticed about boat building and rowing, although you approach it in a different way. There's some illustrations.
Yeah, exactly. Kids tend to be pretty visual. And so instead of material about the various parts of the stroke, for instance, the mechanics of rowing, we substituted an illustration at the back of the book. And we provided a timeline. We provided a visual gallery to introduce each of the characters so that kids could keep track of who was who.
How else do you think about writing for young adults? If memory serves, I don't have the book right in front of me, but I think the first line is, "This is a true story," which I thought...
That's right.
What a great way to start a book for young people. But, I mean, you're kind of scholarly in your writing. Did you feel you had to talk down to them? I mean, how did you think about writing for younger people?
Well, I think it's really important not to talk down, of course, and to pull back on the whatever degree of scholarliness there is to my voice and make it simple and transparent so you are telling them a story. I try to think of it as sitting down next to them as I would sit down next to one of my daughters and telling them a story and making sure that the language is clear and appropriate and that the arc of the story is still there. I really wanted to make sure that the emotional experience of the book, the heart of the book, remained there because that's really what makes it worth reading.
Oh, it's such a great book. And the story that you tell of the University of Washington's rowing team was overshadowed by the success of African-American runner Jesse Owens at the Berlin Olympics. Then you write this book and people are like, how is this possible? I'd never heard of this before. Were you surprised at the chord that it struck?
Yeah, we thought it would do well, but to tell you the truth, I and the publisher both, I think, have been somewhat surprised at just how deeply it's resonated with so many different people. And I think in a sort of roundabout way relates to the Jesse Owens story. Jesse Owens' story is a great American story because mm-hmm. it helps define who we are as a people. But it's a story, amongst other things, of great individual achievement or achievements. This is a story about great team achievement, and I think it resonates partly because it reminds us that part of who we are, historically at least, is a people who have been pretty good at building great teams and getting great things done.
Yeah. Daniel, one last thought. Our producer, Emiko, points out the race is on YouTube, which is how kids get their history. What would you say to a kid who says, I saw that on YouTube, it's really cool. What would you say to convince them, oh, no, you got to read this book?
Yeah, it is cool. I mean, the clip of the gold medal race is very compelling. I think, though, what I would say is that, okay, that's cool. What they did is amazing. That 6 minutes in Berlin was amazing. But how did they get there? How did they get to be that good? How did they manage to stand on the world stage and beat a German boat in front of Hitler? Who were they? Where'd they come from? What motivated them? What values did they have? And can you learn any lessons from learning about who they were and where they came from?
Well, it's a terrific story, and it's told by Daniel James Brown in his new YA version of his best-selling book, The Boys in the Boat. Daniel, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
And we'll have that YouTube video at hereandnow.org. Here's a taste.
Zu spät! Zu spät! Amerika hat gesiegt!
Amerika has won. Show the video to your kids and then get the book when it comes out next week.
Many of the country's biggest coal deposits are on federal land, and that land belongs to the American public. So when companies mine coal, they make payments to the federal government and to states. About those payments, critics say they are far too low. The issue of royalty payments is at the heart of an ongoing conflict, and now the Federal Bureau of Land Management is considering making changes to the royalty program. Lee Patterson of Here and Now contributor Inside Energy attended a hearing on the debate in Gillette, Wyoming. She prepared this report.
The pre-hearing rally began under a bright white tent in Gillette, a town deep in Wyoming's coal country.
We have folks from Alpha Coal West, from Arch Coal, and the Thunder Basin Coal Company. Give yourselves a hand.
That's Travis Detai from the Wyoming Mining Association, the sponsor of the so-called Stop New Energy Taxes rally. It was a warm-up act for the main event at the local library.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be in Wyoming.
Janice Schneider with the Department of the Interior welcomed the crowd to a listening session
about how the Bureau of Land Management can best manage its coal resources.
40% of America's coal is on federal land. Under the current system, critics say coal companies often pay less, sometimes far less, in royalties than the required 12.5%. Hundreds showed up, including Wyoming's governor and the state's entire Washington, D.C. delegation. Senator John Barrasso was one of the first to speak.
I find it extremely hypocritical for the administration to ask whether it's getting a fair return on federal coal when it's gone to such length to suppress the demand for coal.
Barrasso gets at the root cause of the frustration expressed by so many at this meeting and at similar hearings across the country this summer. It all comes down to this. Coal miners are fighting for jobs, many of which are enabled by the federal coal program. But those jobs are threatened in part by new climate regulations. A possible hike in royalties is seen as yet another threat.
What you're proposing will be devastating to our community, to our kids, and to our families.
And pardon me, please, if I seem a little nervous and uneasy. You know, my livelihood does lie in the balance here.
We don't want to be forced onto welfare in Gillette. We want to work and pay our way through life without asking for government assistance.
That was Sherry England, coal miner J.J. Mendoza, and grandmother Penny Russell. The meeting became a platform for sounding off on everything happening in the coal industry right now. Layoffs, bankruptcies, decreased demand, and of course, one of the biggest factors of them all.
While discussing the economic impacts of coal is necessary, this conversation would be incomplete without acknowledging the basic scientific realities that the climate is changing.
That's Sam Pennington, a college student. During the entire four-hour meeting, there was almost no mention of the elephant in the room.
That we are responsible, and that coal is the number one contributor to climate change.
Colin Marshall is the CEO of Cloud Peak Energy, one of the largest coal companies in Wyoming. He agreed. The conversation was incomplete.
If they said we'd just like the coal to stay in the ground because they were concerned about climate, I think they'd be being honest. Then you could have actually a discussion about climate change.
If royalty rates go up, that could keep more coal in the ground. That's an outcome high on the agenda for some groups like the Sierra Club that are pushing for reform. All this debate reveals a disconnect at the federal level between the federal coal program itself, which has produced around 5 billion tons of coal over the past decade, and the Obama administration's climate change agenda, aimed in part at burning less coal. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell acknowledged that tension during a speech earlier this year.
Coal is going to continue to be an important part of our nation's energy mix in the future. How do we manage the program in a way that's consistent with our climate change objectives?
It's a challenging question for lawmakers and regulators who are walking a fine line these days between supporting energy development and, in this case, thousands of coal jobs while continuing to battle climate change. For Here and Now, I'm Lee Patterson.
Well, there were many losses over the weekend. Author Oliver Sacks, filmmaker Wes Craven. We want to note the loss of someone at the beginning of a career. 21-year-old Kyle Jean-Baptiste died after misstepping and falling from a fire escape in Brooklyn. In June, he became the understudy for the role of Jean Valjean in Les Miserables, then made history last month when he became both the youngest and the first Black actor to play the part. He was scheduled to move on and join the cast of The Color Purple this fall. Last week he tweeted, "I thank everyone who supported me and still does. I'll never forget this experience, Les Miserables, onward and upward." Well, here's the voice that was stilled, singing the song Rise from the musical Republic earlier this year.
And they won't see me coming, some kid with a gun. It's my disguise. They don't know I will imitate the sun. And I will rise when the streets are filled.
Again, Kyle Jean-Baptiste was 21 when he died this weekend. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.